We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
Spin 103.8.
You're listening to Spin's movie show, We Love Movies. Rory Cashin and Brian Lloyd are here. One of the big films out this weekend is The Girl on the Train, starring Emily Blunt. She's just one of the big stars that features in this film. Rory, you had a chance to check this one out. What's going on with the story?
Emily Blunt takes the train to work every day, and she finds herself becoming obsessed with two separate homes on the way into work. One of which is her ex-home, where her ex-husband, who's played by Justin Theroux, is currently living with his once mistress but now wife, who's played by Rebecca Ferguson, and their new daughter. And then a couple of houses up from that, there's what she perceives to be a perfect couple, who played by Luke Evans and that lady from Magnificent Seven, whose name I can't remember. And they're like a beautiful couple, and she, you know, makes up a love story in her mind of what their couple might be like. And then one day, going into work, she sees the lady kissing another man who isn't Luke Evans. Okay. And she gets a little bit upset and almost like personally assaulted by, you know, her seeing this other woman who's ruining a perfect relationship. And then the very next day, that lady who was kissing the other man goes missing. And it was the same night Emily Blunt got so drunk that she had a bit of a blackout and woke up covered in blood. So she's all like, I don't know what happened. Am I a suspect? Did I actually witness something that I can't remember because I was so drunk? I guess we'll have to watch the film and find out.
Ooh, okay. Let's take a clip anyway.
Hayley Bennett.
Oh, I thank you. Phone here.
Thank Hayley you, IMDb.
Bennett, the girl from The Magnificent Seven. Yes. Now, finally, we can put that to rest. Anyway, here is a quick clip from the film.
I saw someone with Megan Hipwell, but not on Friday night. She was having an affair. She had a lover. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
I thought you didn't know her.
No, but I saw her.
You saw her where?
I saw her from the train. She was standing on the deck with this man.
With her husband, Scott Hipwell?
No, it wasn't him. This man was different, and they were kissing.
Wow, that's pretty coincidental, isn't it? You just happened to be on a train at the same exact moment that a woman you don't know but somehow recognize is cheating on her husband?
I know it sounds crazy.
Neighbor saw a drunk woman in the vicinity of her house Friday night. Megan Hipwell does bear a resemblance to Anna Watson. Mrs. Watson reported that you go to their house sometimes uninvited, and that on one occasion you actually broke in and took their child.
As I mentioned earlier on, Rory, lots of expectation for this movie, huge anticipation because the book was an absolute massive bestseller.
Yeah,
the director of this is the same guy who did The Help and Gotta Get Up, or I think it was the James Brown biopic, which a lot of people were like,
yeah, it was good. It had a lot of good central performance, I think.
Yeah. A bit rose tinted on L. James. So for this one, for the outsiders who haven't read the book, you might think, oh, could this be 2016's Gone Girl?
Yeah.
You're kind of hoping it'll be a thriller of that ilk. But I'm hearing very mixed reports.
Yeah. I think the problem is that anyone going in expecting, you know, a pulpy, fun thriller like Gone Girl might be very disappointed, because it's a lot more concerned with getting into the psychology of someone with a very difficult abuse problem, like Emily Blunt's character does, because she is like a really bad alcoholic. And then you find out more and more about everyone's individual lives, like her past relationship with Justin Theroux. It turns out she was a bit of a domestic abuser.
Mm-hmm. She abused him?
Yeah.
Wow.
Hayley Bennett's character had a massive tragedy in her life that's leading her on this very destructive trail that she's on. Rebecca Ferguson, who is, as the once mistress and now wife, you know, a relationship built on that foundation. Mm-hmm. She's constantly then questioning, you know, if he left her for me, will he leave me for the next one? So there's this constant kind of shifting undercurrent, and it's all very like heavy. And it's not necessarily fun watch like the way Gone Girl was, because Gone Girl was like this sexy kind of Hitchcockian blonde bombshell who was going around ruining lives. Whereas in this, it's very like, oh, it's kind of a bit, it's kind of a little bit sad.
Is it a bit also dull?
No, I didn't think so, because everything kept moving forward. And once Hayley Bennett's character goes missing, like, there's still lots of flashbacks leading up to her current situation. But, you know, they leave like five or six potential people who might be, you know, the reason why she has gone missing. And it's all about finding out why it is she's gone missing and why everyone is so interlinked in her life story. And on top of that, you have Emily Blunt giving like yet another amazing performance, because it's very difficult to act drunk. People do it. It's quite, it can be very, it can come off very cheesy, but she does it magnificently well. And as you know, everyone else in it is really, really good as well, except for Luke Evans. But you know, it's, he's not the worst in the world, but he is the worst in this film.
Okay, you want to jump in there, Brian?
Can I ask you something, right?
You can ask me anything you want.
If a different director, like let's say if David Fincher got a hold of this, would it be a different film? I mean, obviously it would be a different film, but do you think it's something, the fact, like, because like, I remember The Help, and like, The Help was fine. Yeah. It was a fine film. There was
But you felt it was also a very a superficial take on a, on that story,
exactly.
That you felt that they could have gone darker and they could have gone a lot deeper.
They could have done a lot more with it, and I feel like it's the same here. Like, I think if there was a different director, it might have had a bit more of a flash to it.
I think like my primary issue was is that like the film was written by a woman, the screenplay was written by a woman, the three kind of narrators of the film, because like it's mostly Emily Blunt, but you also get Rebecca Ferguson and Hayley Bennett's POV as the film goes on, and then it would have been nice just to have a female director coming at it, because obviously she would be a far more insightful person to bring that kind of that aspect of the story forward, because it's all about the individual different female tragedies that can occur to women over the course, and then they've pinned this kind of whodunit on top of it.
Okay.
So if you're expecting a more Finchery thriller thing, I think that's why people were coming out and going, what was that?
Would the right director for this, just to, before we get scores, Lynn Ramsey, who made We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
Who dropped out of doing Jane Got a Gun. Was that
the awful Western one?
I wonder, could this have been in her wheelhouse? Would she maybe been the person?
Or even, I know I keep mentioning this every time we talk about female directors, Jennifer Kent, who did The Babadook.
Yeah.
She did psychological stuff so well in that. She could have knocked us out of the park.
Is she not going to be doing Captain Marvel, though?
She's doing something really weird and small and Australian. And she's actually gone, in my opinion, a little bit backwards in terms of her career, because The Babadook was like this massive calling card, and now she's doing this tiny film that, like, from the synopsis, I was like, who on earth is going to read? Who's going to
watch this? Yeah.
Okay, right. Okay, let's get scores then anyway. The Girl on the Train.
7.5 out of 10.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden. Spin
103.8. Now, War on Everyone is out in cinemas. Brian Lloyd and Rory Cashin join me in studio. Rory, you check this one out.
Yep.
A lot of expectation on this one too, bearing in mind the film's director is John Michael McDonagh, the man who helmed and wrote The Guard and Calvary. Two very strong films. You're kind of hoping that he's going to be on a winner with War on Everyone. I have to say, when I was in that reporter's room, people were very split on it.
Mm. Yeah, well, like, I can totally understand that. It is very, I can see why it's very, very divisive. I did not enjoy this film at all. Mm, and really? you know I came at it with love of The Guard and with love of Calvary. And I was anticipating to love this, and I came out and the lovely PR lady for the film was like, what do you think? And I just had to do that kind of shake the head.
Oh,
I was like, no,
dear God.
No, my name won't be on that poster. No.
Oh, God. Okay, do you know what I'm going to do? I want to play a little section from the trailer to warn everyone, because the trailer, I have to say, was very strong to the point where you think, oh, we're in for a cracker here. But let's just give an idea of what people are in for with the movie. Here's a clip.
Welcome back, boys. I received very serious allegations of assault. Corruption charges against you.
Are you trying to bribe us, man?
No.
Now, what have we learned?
Bribery and corruption, bad.
Yes. Progress has been made.
So there's a little section there from the trailer to War on Everyone. You think that this is going to run at a mile a minute. What's not working in it, Rory?
It's. I think it's just the tone of it. Like, it's going for this real kind of Tarantino-y. Do you remember after Reservoir Dogs, and I guess maybe just after Pulp Fiction, it felt like every second film coming out of America and England was a cheap Tarantino ripoff, and they were all mostly terrible. This reminded me a lot of that era when everyone was just like smart talking and they all sounded the same, and there was pointless profanity and pointless violence and pointless over-sexualization, and it was just real like a 14-year-old who loved Limp Bizkit wrote the screenplay and managed to get all these actors in it. Like, do you know what I mean?
Limp Bizkit. Hang on a sec. What's your problem? Oh.
I don't have a problem with Limp Bizkit. I'm trying to get across the writer of this film, what it feels like. It was just very, just kind of, isn't being mean to your own kids, isn't that hilarious? And isn't, you know, running over a mime because, you know, they don't make any sounds isn't that hilarious. You're just kind of like...
That's kind of funny. Like, like, sorry.
Well, then maybe you will actually enjoy it since you were that 14-year-old who loved Limp Bizkit. But
Slipknot, actually, but whatever.
Oh, my God.
I'd love to see that script.
Okay. But it was just... I don't know. It just... It didn't work because as kind of irreverent it was trying to be, the plot itself was actually so crazy dark that the things they were making jokes about was just distasteful. It was just, it was in bad taste, and it just left, it was just like, kind of like, oh.
Ooh, okay then, Rory. Out of 10.
4.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
Spin 1038. Now, when We Love Movies, we are going to take a look at two documentaries which are playing in select cinemas this weekend. One is De Palma, which is Brian De Palma, the acclaimed director, giving us his insight, no holds barred take on his career to date. And also we have Mattress Men. Brian, you checked out Mattress Men. What's going on with this one?
It basically tells the story of Mattress Mick, the mattress salesman who's down on Pierce Street, and then there's another one over on Coolock. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, he had this kind of really strange viral celebrity videos that people may remember, where it was like him dancing around and talking about mattresses. And it's basically about the guy who made those videos, a man by the name of Paul Kelly. And at first you think it's going to be about, you know, how, you know, he became this viral sensation, but what really the story is about one man trying to kind of come off the dole and try to create something for himself using his imagination. It's a little bit, I don't want to say forced in places, but there are certain parts of this story that you're watching and thinking, like, this is just a little bit too scripted. This is just a little bit too kind of trite or something. But overall, I mean, it was a gorgeous little story.
Okay, let's just take a little section from the trailer to Mattress Men.
I'm back with a bang. We're just going to do one line at a time, then I'll animate and edit everything else in.
There's no recession. Everybody can have what they want.
Please welcome Mattress Mick.
We are going viral.
We're on YouTube. Mattress Mick back with a bang.
Without you, he would be out on the street.
Nobody's going to take control of me, because I am me.
Mattress Mick has saved my life.
Mattress shop. A little section there from the trailer to Mattress Men. Brian, I also had a chance to check this one out. And it's interesting what you said, that you felt some bits were forced. And that really comes through in the trailer. There are times where you think, oh, Paul, it's like you're over-egging things here.
Yeah.
By all accounts, it took 3 years to make this. And if I'm being honest with you, I think they focused too much on Paul. Bearing in mind, Mattress Mick is what everyone is really interested about. No disrespect to Paul, but he takes too much attention away from Mick in this. And granted, he's a fella who wants to get off the dole. He wants to make a living for himself. But you feel, because it lingers so much on his storyline, I think it takes away from getting under the skin of Mick and learning more about him and about how, when he was at his lowest, when his business was crumbling, they created this character of Mattress Mick through Paul to try and elevate his business. I wanted to learn more about Mick the man, as opposed to constantly seeing Paul Kelly.
Yeah, no, don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, it's what I would guess myself was because the fact that they were filming it for 3 years, I mean, you do something for that long, you're going to have a huge amount of footage, and then you've got to try and make a story out of it. And I would guess myself it was the sort of thing of, right, we've got one film here where it's him discussing where Mattress Mick came from and where this character came from and why his business was in the doldrums, and then we've got this other redemption story about Paul Kelly getting himself off the dole and all the rest of it. So which are people going to want to see more? Well, I think the redemption story would play better.
Do you think, though, as well, that this redemption story would have worked better, though, as maybe an RT2 Reality Bites?
Do you know what? Funny you should say that, because I was watching this, I was thinking, do you know what? If they made a TV series out of Mattress Mick and Paul Kelly, I would absolutely watch it. I would tune in every week and watch it. And I do get the sense that maybe this was set up initially as a kind of, reality, or not reality TV, but like a TV kind of series. I do get the sense that this might have worked better in that. But yeah, I mean, as it is, it's a gorgeous little film. I mean, it really does have a lot of heart to it. It's really, really charming as well.
I thought they missed out on more humour within it, because there are some of the employees, like Brian, who constantly has the mattress. He's wearing that.
Yeah.
And he's out on the street. He's trying to get people into the shop. And there's some great moments with him interacting with the public. And you thought, there's almost a whimsical charm, which could have been a little bit peppered throughout the documentary. But out of 10, what would you give it, Brian?
I mean, out of 10, I'd give it like an 8 out of 10. I mean, it's a really good documentary. I mean, it has a lot of heart to it. but it looks... I mean, it's one of the very few films I've seen where Dublin looks like Dublin. Do you know that kind of way? I watched it and I said, yeah, that looks like home. That looks like Dublin. Mm-hmm. And it's a great story as well. I can't fault it for any of these things. You are right in what you're saying. I would love them to have seen a bit more about how the character was created, but, you know... If anything comes out of this, I would hope there would be a TV series out of it.
Yeah, it just feels, I think, duration-wise, a bit overstretched.
A little bit.
It felt like there's not enough story to warrant the 1 hour, 20 minutes. But you can see it in select cinemas this weekend, along with De Palma, a documentary all about acclaimed director Brian De Palma. Before we hear what Rory thought of it, let's just take a little section from the trailer.
You've got to realize you're being criticized against the fashion of the day. And when the fashion changes, everybody forgets about that.
Being a director is being a watcher. You have a lot of egos in the room, and you have to sort of watch how they interact with each other. There was Marty and I, then there was George and Francis and Stephen. What we did in our generation will never be duplicated. You're battling a very difficult system, and all the values of that system are the opposite of what goes into making original good movies.
Rory, Brian De Palma, he's a director I think can split an awful lot of people. He's made some incredible films, but he's made some awful muck as well.
Oh yeah, well yeah, like you can say that about just about anyone who's worked for like 40 or 50 years in the industry. He was part of that, you know, movie brat thing with Spielberg and Coppola and Lucas and Scorsese, but I think he's often like kind of the odd one out because he his biggest box office hit was
Mission Impossible,
which was very late into his career, and like his one, I guess his two biggest calling cards are either a horror film or a gangster movie remake that people are quicker to make fun of than enjoy at this rate. But like, yeah, like it was interesting to have the insight into a director who was so obviously influenced by
Hitchcock,
and he's just so clearly like in love with Hitchcock's like point of view, and as he says in the film, he's like, Hitchcock was such an influential director, but there's no one except me who seems to be aping his film style. So yeah, like watching the documentary De Palma, is anyone any interest whatsoever in filmmaking or the last 40 or 50 years of film, it's a very important watch, I think. But it's also just interesting to hear a little bit of gossip, you know, behind the scenes of some of the biggest films ever made.
Because the thing is, with Noam Baumbach and his collaborator on this, they don't have a series of talking heads. This is Brian De Palma in front of a fireplace, and it's just the camera's rolling, and just they're just feeding him, and he's just spewing all this stuff from his past and all about the industry and about how he's managed to get movies made.
Yeah, just it kicks off with him in college and then moves on through every single one of his films, one by one. And cutaways to, you know, specific parts of the films maybe that he was talking about, like the long tracking shot in Snake Eyes, or his love of split screen, like in Carrie and stuff, and how it works in some examples and it doesn't work in other examples, in his opinion. And then, you know, just talking about how Paul Schrader initially gave Taxi Driver to De Palma, but De Palma gave it to Scorsese because he thought it was more suited to him, and the whole casting kind of pen thing when, you know, he was doing Carrie and Lucas was doing Star Wars, and how some people were so close to playing one character, and then there was just kind of a swap around for all of them, and it's just like, it was very interesting. Like, to be fair, as a film nerd like me, I kind of knew most of it already, but you know, if you go in with any kind of interest in that kind of stuff, there's loads of nuggets in there that even I was like, oh, I had no idea.
Just before we get scores on it, because like that, he can be quite a prickly individual, De Palma, especially when it comes to critics, because not all his films are great, so critics have been quite harsh on some of them. How does he come across in the documentary? Did you come away liking the man?
It would have been interesting just to have anyone else talking it aside from him, because obviously it feels less like a documentary and more just like an interview, and so we're only getting one person's opinion, and it's that person's opinion on his own stuff. He does bring in the critics, like Pauline Kael really liked a lot of his stuff, but he does bring in the fact that so many other critics hated it, and how some of his films over time initially were hated and then eventually came to be loved.
What was that one, Dressed to Kill? That one with Michael Caine.
Yeah.
That one was brilliant.
Oh yeah.
Like, that was savage when it was released. Like, people just hated that film, but you watch it now, like, it's so cool.
Like, some of the stuff he's done, like, you're just like, you did that?
Yeah.
You did Bonfires of the Vanity, and then did, like, what was the other one? Raising Kane. Like, he's such an odd CV.
It's quite an eclectic one. Out of 10, Rory?
7 out of 10.
7 out of 10 for De Palma, which is playing also in select cinemas this weekend.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
Spin 103.8.